Hey folks, we're back. It's a goodlifebabe.com. Jeff and Joel's Tales from New Orleans, episode 78.
Hey, welcome back. It's goodlifebabe.com. Jeff and Joel's Tales from New Orleans, episode 78. We have Jonathan Ferrara in the house. Welcome, Jonathan. Thank you for coming on the show.
My pleasure to be here.
It's nice to see you. I've been knowing you for, 20 years or so?
Long time.
Yeah, exactly. We're going to get into a bunch of stuff with Jonathan, but a little housekeeping first, right, Jeff?
You want to tell the folks a little bit about what Jonathan does?
Yeah, want to start with that before housekeeping?
Sure.
Yeah. Well, Jonathan, you are you own an art gallery.
Jonathan. Yeah, I'm an artist. Gallerist, activist, cultural producer, et cetera, whatever title fits, whatever day it is.
Yeah.
Whatever hour it is.
It's the New Orleans hustle.
Yeah.
Where a man of many hats. Not only many hats, I got to say that you also are man. The kilts that you wear?
Everybody asks me that question. it's called a galaba or a galabia, or people call it a dishdasha or a dashiki.
Yeah.
Basically, like the white robes that like Saudi Arabians wear, and there's a reason why they wear it because it's hot as shit in Saudi Arabia. So I wear it to Jazz Fest.
You rock it, dude.
And people call me Jazz. I don't call myself this, but call me Jazz Fest Jesus. So it's kind of, I'm the guy with the shaved head, the earrings, the goatee, and the white robe and a cell phone in my hand.
That's awesome, dude. That's great. Well, we've got a bunch of stuff to talk to you about. An event that you're producing this week. That's related to Prospect 4.
Yeah.
We've got your book to talk about. Mm-hmm. But do you want to do some housekeeping, or do we just want to get it?
Yeah, why don't you lead it off?
With the housekeeping?
Yeah.
Well, Mueller.
Oh, yeah, so Mueller, today. Yeah, and Jonathan, Mueller, look, man, chime in, whatever you want to.
Mueller.
Exactly. You know, anyone?
Yeah, we just kind of feel like we got to address the 800-pound gorilla in the room right now, because today is probably the equivalent to, I don't even know what it was during the Nixon scandal, maybe when the tapes finally got released or something like that. In this Trump-Russian scandal, the water broke today in a big way. I don't think ever in the history of this country that somebody who was labeled the campaign manager for a president of the United States has been arrested by the FBI. And the guy turned himself in today along with one of his aides. But as seemingly important as that story was, none of the items related to his indictment were in and of themselves related to the Russian inquiry. They were other items that come across basically as bare bones gangsterism when you get down to it. It's just money laundering, racketeering, fraud, every other kind of American hucksterism that you can think of.
Yeah.
Wolf of Wall Street. Yeah, right, exactly. But the really important thing that happened today is that it was revealed that a guy named Papadopoulos, George Papadopoulos, I think his name was, was a so-called low-level operator. He was a foreign policy consultant that was officially assigned to the Trump campaign. And if they put a lid on this, a rock-solid lid on this, since June, which is practically unheard of in Washington politics, but you're talking about a guy named Mueller, apparently, who's a formidable character. And they locked it down, and they had arrested this guy in, I think, late June or July, and he pled guilty today in what seems like a string of things that are all timed to prevent other distractions, like it's Hillary Clinton's fault and the DNC, and stuff like that. But that guy, everything about his arrest and his guilt is related to collusion with the Russian government. And so that part of the story got moved forward. Most of the news emphasis has been on the Manafort side of things, because Manafort's a more high profile figure, but from the standpoint of pushing the Russia thing forward and possible impeachment of Trump, that's That's right. Definitely a more important thing. The water broke on it. I mean, people are getting arrested. That's crazy.
And the
That's
deflection crazy. Has already started.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. Right Circus. Off the bat. Yeah.
Yeah, I think this is like you said, it's a watershed moment. It's just starting.
Yeah, it's just getting started. It's like, you can imagine, because you go back and you read about the Nixon stuff, the tapes came out, and nobody knew what was on the tapes, you know, when they came out. They're like, oh, there's these tapes, something is on them, then they get reviewed, then it just keeps getting worse and worse and worse. They peel off one guy who doesn't want to go to jail, you know, and that's what you have, apparently, with the Stephanopoulos guy, Papadopoulos. I'm doing the Greek thing.
The Greek conflation.
Yeah, exactly. With this Papadopoulos guy, he is cooperating with the FBI, and he's telling them everything that he knows, you know, and certainly that's a lot.
Exactly.
Because I read part of the indictment today against him, and it's not pretty, you know.
It's ugly. I mean,
it's really ugly. Yeah. It's like you were an idiot, right? I mean, without saying that, like, you were an idiot.
And he pled guilty.
And it's like you knowingly conspired with agents of the Russian government who were known agents, and you were informed that they were agents.
I think they call that what's that? What do they call that? Treason?
They call it treason. Right.
You're fucked.
You're fucked. Exactly.
So that, I mean, and the Saints won 5 in a row. I just got to say that real quick.
Saints have won 5 in a row. Yeah.
So, and Fats Domino's second line's coming up, right?
Fats Domino. I love the fact that Sean Payton was sporting the Fats Domino.
Well, everybody was on their helmets, too, on the back of their helmets.
They had the Fats thing on the back of the
helmet. What a thoughtful organization.
I know. That was really cool.
Really beautiful.
And people in the... You know,
hats off.
That's what I love. That from the standpoint that people in the rest of the country are just like, what is that? They don't even understand what it's about. But everyone here knows exactly what it's about. It's great.
And now there's a movement from, who's leading it? David Lee Simmons or
John Cleary.
To petition that the formerly known as Lee Circle becomes Fats Domino Circle.
Oh, that's been... That was,
John Cleary... posted
finally a replacement for that shit. Yeah,
exactly.
This super sweet post on Facebook that was about him visiting Fats a couple of years ago, where he tells a story that Fats couldn't really remember things at the time, and he had a kind of a dazed look on his face, and he started playing the piano, and Fats came over, and there's video of this as well. It's amazing, and Fats comes over, and he just starts doing his virtuosic thing. Along playing a duet with John Cleary, and so anyway, I can possibly tell the story as well as he wrote it on Facebook. Just look up John Cleary on Facebook if you're listening and you want to see and hear that story. But it's apparently he started a change.org petition for what it's worth, and I hope it's worth something to get people to listen.
Happened, right?
Have that change to Fats.
Yep.
Fat Circle or Fats Domino Square or whatever the case may be.
And I think the last bit of housekeeping before we get into Jonathan's being here as our guest and his what he's up to and his story is you just did the Natchez Chase ride fundraiser.
That's right.
For Meals on Wheels.
That's right.
455 miles.
Well, officially it's 444 miles.
Okay.
From Nashville to Natchez.
Yeah.
On the Natchez Trace. But you know, you get off for a mile and a half here and there,
sure.
Or you go here or whatever, you know, so it evens out at about 450, maybe a little bit more. No, it was not all flat. It was semi-mountainous at the beginning, you know, big hills coming out of the Appalachians.
That's a bitch.
So it was like 2 days worth of climb riding and stuff and going downhill. But we put that at the beginning, you know, which was really smart. I have to credit Tracy for that. She's a genius and in terms of planning. And it was just us two. I'll tell you a little funny part about it. And maybe we'll do a We Call You with Matt Burke at some point.
Sure.
A buddy of mine who lives in Gulfport, Mississippi now, used to live here, but is from New York and lived in Boston for a long time. And he's a tell it like it is kind of guy, as you can imagine, from the Northeast. And he's like, He's like, "Oh man, you're gonna crush it out there. You're gonna find some other guys who are 46 around your age. You're gonna lock in with them, and then you're gonna be dominating and crushing these guys out." You know, like he's talking that talk to me and everything, trying to get me jazzed for the ride. Sure. Why not? I can tell you this: there are no groups out there doing this.
Right.
Yeah. There was no locking in with any other group or any kind of like competitive cycling where you might be motivated.
It's a tour of isolation.
It was a, it was Tracy and I all the way.
Did you have music on or no?
No. See, Tracy might have had some, like, because she wears the earbuds and stuff.
See, I ride with music, man.
You ride with music? Yeah, that's the only way, huh? Yeah.
For 400 miles, you could listen to a couple audiobooks, man.
Oh, yeah, you certainly
could. Dirty Dick.
When I was a competitive runner, I'm almost jealous because when I was a competitive runner, the thing that I hated most was the socialization. I'm like, can you just leave me alone? Oh,
you didn't like that part, yeah. No. Right.
Yeah, see, I ride solo, too,
like, stop telling me, because... Then it's like a Larry David thing. It's like every single person that I pass says, "Nice job, keep it up." And I'm supposed to say something back? No, I'm here to get in my zen space, dude.
Or even talking like takes your breath.
Exactly.
It's like, takes more breath. You know?
Well,
like...
but look, here's the thing I'll say to that is that like I typically am still isolated when I ride in groups, but there's a certain thing sometimes, you know, when you're on like the 45th mile or something like that, you know, and you're just like, I'm going to get behind this person. Yeah. I don't care. There's not a lot of conversation going on, but it helps to motivate you to be next to people, totally. You know, that are doing
your
it.
Your pace increases for sure.
Your pace increases. Yeah, exactly. You don't have that quit in you necessarily, sure. You know, that might be lying there. But there was none of that, you know, it was like,
that sucks.
It was a slog the whole way, you know, in a certain sense.
It's a long
slog,
man.
It only got cold on the last day. That's one thing I can say. That was great. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it rained on us one time, one day early on.
Yeah.
You know, all the rain, this big squall line passed through overnight.
Riding the rains.
I know. I know. We were prepared to do it, but thankfully it happened at night. And I don't know what else. I mean, there were animals and things along the way. There was this really kind of magical moment when we were riding. We saw this creature go across the path in front of us, and both of us were like, "What the heck is that thing, man?" You know, because you think you're gonna see a black bear at some point. I don't. You know, it's in everybody's head, right. No matter what. You know, like you hear about them. Out there in the world somewhere, you know, and you're like, if it's ever going to happen, it's going to be on this trip, you know? Yeah. So this little thing goes across the road, and we're looking at it, and we're like, I don't know. But it didn't look bearish at all. It looked not like that. And so anyway, we got up on it, and it was this, like, cute piglet that had, like, gotten out of some pen somewhere. And I can't tell you how much this influenced the whole thing, man. It made things so much better.
Oh, that's great.
Like just seeing this piglet.
Nature.
When you also had that moment where you realized, like, I mean, I don't even know if you want to go down this rabbit hole real quick, because we do have to get to Jonathan, but the story about just, again, the white racist... I mean, I don't even know what you would call it, but the folks who, like, warned you versus the black dude that you guys hung out with. You told a great story the other night. We don't even have to go.
Well,
there.
I'll just say, I mean, you know, it's the whitey card.
It's the whitey card.
Yeah, yeah. People play the whitey card
in Mississippi. No way.
Yeah, right. You know, the whitey card is like if you're white and I'm white, and you know I'm a white racist, then you must also be that, so I can talk to you about all that stuff openly, right. Simply
you can
because
feel my pain for being white
because we're in the same space together, you know, and that happened. Like we got it about the monuments. Isn't that a shame about those monuments down there? And I was like, not really. It's kind of cool. And and then there was like the warning when we were in Jackson, you know, the woman pulled up and she was like, "Warning, you're in a black neighborhood. I'm warning you." And I was just like looking
light at her. Light bulb, I live in New Orleans.
No, well, light bulb, I live in New Orleans. But the other thing I was like, do you warn the old black ladies that live in this neighborhood when they're walking down the street?
Right.
She's like, not really. I don't think that's happening, you know? I just don't think it's happening. So,
welcome to America.
America. That happened quite a few times while we were out there, kind of to be expected. And there were some great things to see. Like some of those small towns are kind of ridiculous.
And just real quick, people can still donate, right?
People can still donate. You can go to crowdrise.com, look up Wheels for Meals, Jeff and Tracy's ride for Houston Food Bank, and it's also on Facebook as well, which is we've got a donut, donate, cool. A donut button.
Word. Donut. So, Jonathan.
Yes.
Speaking of America.
Yes.
Where do you hail from?
Born and raised in Towson, Maryland, outside of Baltimore. Lived there until I was 17. Oh. I moved to West Germany when it was West Germany, so you can tell you how old I am.
Wow.
My mother worked for the Department of the Army, so I graduated from high school on Ramstein Air Force Base.
Get the hell out of here.
We lived in a German village. And then I came back to the United States, went to college at Penn State, degree in international business. I ran the largest collegiate philanthropy in the United States called the Penn State Dance Marathon. It's something called THON. And when I was in charge of the whole thing when I was a senior, like 2,000 people.
Yeah.
And we raised $500,000 in 1989. They now raise about $13 million.
Get so it's a
major,
here,
major deal. And it's quite significant. And so then I moved to Boston. I was a banker in Boston. And then I came down here to be a corporate fundraiser with United Way. And Ray Nagin was my lead volunteer.
What?
Yes, indeed. I used to whisper in his ear and say, hey, Ray, ask this guy for 50 grand. Wasn't the sharpest stick in the box at that time either. But and then wow. I quit my job, sold my car. Lived off a difference in what I owed, and rode a bicycle for 5 years and opened my first gallery in 1995 or 1996, something like that.
That was a place that was right near what
Positive Space. And,
yeah.
I was be between Juan's Flying Burrito and Aiden Gill, right on Magazine Street, right in front of the then infamous St. Thomas Housing Project. It was 40% occupied. We had AK-47 gunfire going off every night. The gallery was burglarized. People were robbed. I mean, it was the hood, you know.
How did you go from the financial world to visual art?
So there was a sidebar in there. When I got out of college, it was the recession of 1989, and I moved to Boston, and I didn't have a job. I didn't know anybody besides. Slept on my cousin's couch. He was a senior in college, and I worked at the Hard Rock Cafe. I was a bouncer at the Hard Rock Cafe, and I was actually there for the opening of the Pump album by Aerosmith, so I remember lying at Steven Tyler's feet, keeping people away from him. It was very interesting. And a friend had invited me over to paint some T-shirts. And I was like, what? I went over to her house. She stretched this T-shirt over some cardboard, and I just attacked it. She's like, man, most people just sit there and stare at it for an hour. And I just like went crazy. So then I became a banker by day and banker during the daytime, and then at nighttime I would go downstairs in this kind of like basement that we had and just like mess around with stuff. I'd try to do boutique. I didn't know what the fuck I was doing, so I just did it. And then I moved to New Orleans and was a corporate fundraiser, and I didn't know anybody when I moved here, so I basically would work during the daytime and then paint at night, started cutting up wood and just painting on different things, and I started painting on T-shirts, and those T-shirts I'd sold in the French Quarter flea market on the weekends when I wasn't a fundraiser. So it's kind of, you know, like a. Then I started to grow my hair longer when I had hair, and then I just quit my job and sold my car and got out of corporate America and went on my own. So I kind of that was 20, I don't know, many years ago.
Yeah,
my past life regression is what I like to call it.
I love it. And then now currently you're at, where's your gallery now?
Gallery's on Julia Street in the Arts District of New Orleans, 400A Julia Street, right next to Emeril's Restaurant.
Yep. And, I mean, you're quite successful.
Doing all right.
In terms of, I don't know, being an advocate for a visual artist.
I like to think that I try to stick up for my artist. I, you know, actively represent about 20 artists, local, national, international artists. I mean, I do work all across the country. I did projects in Basel, Switzerland last year, Berlin, Germany, Amman, Jordan, doing a project coming up with Mexico. So, you know, try to internationalize my
my program, and but you know, I've always tried to be an advocate for artists and help them to realize their creative vision. And my job as a gallery owner is to help them monetize that so they can, you know, pay their rent, buy a sure. car, have kids, stuff like things like that.
Yeah,
the real deal.
Be sustainable as a human being, as an artist. I get it. So speaking of the last thing you said with what you're doing, you went to Mexico City. And
yeah.
Should we switch his headphones out?
And yeah, you can take those. Right.
Cool.
Yeah.
So you went to Mexico City, Jonathan, and that led into what you're doing at the Contemporary Arts Center, and as well as around in and around Prospect 4 in the coming.
So you know, one of the things about this. For the last 8 years, I've been traveling around the country, around the world, trying to promote the gallery and doing art fairs and different projects than my work at the Aspen Institute. And so as a part of that, about 3 years ago, I was in Switzerland and exhibiting in Art Basel. And I had met these gallery owners from Berlin. I ended up going to Berlin for a couple of days and like ended up doing an exchange show. And so it was kind of a part of my, you know, I guess going back to my past of having lived in Germany. Came full circle. And so I partnered with this gallery in Berlin. They sent an exhibition of German art to here in last January. And then we sent New Orleans artists and another artist from New York to Berlin. So yeah. Kind of this internationalization. So last year, as an extension of that, myself, Dan Cameron, who's the founder of Prospect Biennial, and my gallery director, Matthew Schoeman, and I, we went to Mexico City. We spent about 3 days there. We did studio visits, we did gallery visits, and basically the concept was to have Dan Cameron, who's an expert in Latin American art and expert in all kinds of art, to be honest with you, internationally renowned curator, to have Dan curate an exhibition of contemporary Mexican art here in New Orleans for Prospect. So yeah. That exhibition actually arrived this past weekend from Mexico, and will open this weekend coming up. And it's interesting because we've partnered with the Consulate of Mexico in New Orleans, basically the Mexican government.
And wow.
Working with them has been a real pleasure because they are very active in New Orleans, and they have an art gallery in their consulate. And so the exhibition that Dan curated, which will feature artist Jose Davila, Gabriel de la Mora, Martin Soto Clement, Rafael Lozano Hemmer, Pedro Reyes, Pablo Rosgado, and Hugo Crosthwaite will be at both galleries. So it'll open simultaneously at my gallery and also at the art gallery of the Consulate of Mexico.
Wow. Yeah. Holy cow.
So pretty heavy stuff, and it's really great because
it's amazing.
This is the first group exhibition of contemporary Mexican art ever held in New Orleans and right. in the southeast of the United States. So it's pretty historic.
Wow.
And I hope that people get a chance to come out and see it because it really is something that is it's an educational part as well. One of the things that I've always believed in is, you know, using art as a catalyst for social change. And in working with the Consulate of Mexico, the real thing that came to bear is that there's a lot of this rhetoric that has been kind of spewed, shall we say, from Washington, D.C. about Mexicans and what Mexicans are. And so this is a possibility or a chance using the power of art to educate people about the rich cultural heritage of Mexico, the rich visual culture of Mexico, by having seven of the hottest or most well-known contemporary Mexican artist to exhibit here in New Orleans in conjunction with Prospect Biennial. So it's all very exciting. So it's using art to educate, and it's also it's great stuff.
Yeah, pure and simple. You're right. And are all those artists coming to town?
Two of those artists have already arrived. So Hugo Crosthwaite arrived this evening he lives in Tijuana. He arrived, and then Pablo Rosgado came in last night.
Yep.
They're both doing installations at the art gallery at the consulate.
Yeah.
So they'll be doing on-site installations, and there'll be a Dan Cameron is in town from New York as the curator, and so we have a number of events that are coming up. We've got Thursday at the Contemporary Arts Center, we're doing a panel discussion with Dan Cameron and Pablo Rosgado and Hugo will talk about their work, and Dan will have a kind of a question and answer interview session with them. That's at 6 to 8 p.m. In the Freeport McNamara Inn Theater. I'll also be speaking as well as Consul Ponce, who's the Council of Mexico. And so that's on Thursday. And then Friday, we have a couple of walkthrough private events. And then Saturday, both exhibitions will open at their gallery, my gallery, for the Arts District first Saturday openings.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah.
And for the record, it's now referred to as the CAC Theater.
CAC Theater, well, there you go.
The Freeport McMoran.
They're done.
Done.
Huh. Yeah, no. And yeah. This exhibition will actually, it'll stay up through Prospect Biennial. It'll run from this Saturday through December the 30th. So nice. We're actually kind of timing that to coincide with the VIP opening of Prospect.
Sure.
And Dan Cameron was the founder of Prospect. Really makes sense to bring home the...
Sure. Full circle-ish.
Yeah, totally.
No, that's great, man. Yeah. I'm really looking forward to it. How do I go, if I want to go to the consulate, how do I do that?
So the consulate is located on Diamond Street, right at the Convention Center Boulevard.
Yeah.
And the Mexican consulate, you can look it up online, the Consulate of Mexico.
Yeah.
And that gallery will be open, I believe it's Monday through Saturday from like 9 to 5.
Yep.
And
okay.
Then,
and you just... Roll right in?
Roll right in, yeah. It's actually the consulate's in the front and the gallery's in the back. So Andrew Higgins is how you would enter on that. So the consulate's on Diamond Street. So it's kind of like, one of those flat iron.
God, buildings, that's right? Beautiful. I had no idea.
Yeah, most people didn't know.
Neither did I.
And they're very active. There was just an opening at Newman at the Reynolds Ryan Gallery there. Yeah. They do all kinds of different presentations. And someone told me today, which is very interesting, that this is the oldest U.S. The Mexican consulate here is the oldest U.S. consulate in the United States.
Get out of here.
Because Spain used to rule this territory. Sure. So think about that.
Oh, that makes sense.
Continuous, that's a big deal.
Yeah.
And the council here was in Amsterdam and in Paris, and he chose to come here. And there's a great historic relationship between the two countries. I mean, think about where, like Dan Cameron was talking this morning about Tabasco. Well, Tabasco is a port. In Mexico, it's like the name is like we think about Tabasco, and the commerce between the two countries. What is below us? The Gulf of Mexico. It's not like, but there's always this perception that they're a kind of inferior culture, maybe, or secondary culture.
I've never understood that.
Yeah,
but I've spent a lot of time down there.
But culturally, if you go down there, they're pyramids, that were
the Mayan ruins.
Yeah. Mesoamerican culture millennia is,
Aztec
and that's
ruins.
We're the newcomers, but yet we just kind of think that we
that's ridiculous.
We're the white people, right?
They got the best hammock. They got the best hammocks in the world too.
I went to Mexico.
In Merida.
I've been to Merida, and the beautiful square in there. I stayed at this really funky hotel. It was great.
Yeah.
But the when we go to Mexico City, to me, it was my first time in Mexico City.
There is amazing.
We were like bugs. It's cheap.
It might be the best food in the world.
Of us ate like kings and drank wine.
That's right.
It was like $100.
That's right.
It was ridiculous.
It's unbelievable.
And it was like 5-star restaurants with the best decor. It was, to me, it was like a mixture of New York and New Orleans is what I thought. And it was a city of 24 million people.
That's right.
It's fucking huge.
That's right.
And the art was great.
And it was vast.
Vast. Vast. And that really was very eye-opening to me. And, dude, it's like a three-hour flight from here. It's nothing. You go to Houston, you jump over there. It's like 4 hours total.
Exactly.
Yep. And it's cosmopolitan as well.
I hitchhiked from there to New Orleans once.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty wild.
Yeah. Huh. I did that.
I think there's a direct flight now.
I think there might be. I think it's maybe Southwest. I'm not sure. I think there's...
So you don't have to hitchhike?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know...
It's coming back to the real world.
It's very exciting. I think that, Prospect obviously dials up the international flavor artistically in New Orleans. Has really become a thing in and of itself. And we're just trying, as a satellite exhibition, which is, kind of tied into Prospect, we're just trying to do our part to give people other things to look at besides, the Prospect, the official stuff. This is the kind of, satellite kind of auxiliary
exhibition.
Yeah.
No, that's cool. So that's like when Jazz Fest does their thing and then Superfly does the roots out the street or whatever.
But there's even more of a relationship together because they're not like competing. They're actually we're cross promoting each other and you know, with Dan having founded Prospect and curating it, really makes
It's awesome.
And he's, I mean, dude, he's like world renowned. I mean, the guy knows everybody.
Oh, I love it. Well, I'm glad you guys are going to be at the CAC. On Thursday, November 2nd, 6 to 8, right?
Yep.
Yep. So
open to the public.
Come out, please. It's free.
Free and clear.
Open. Yeah. Cool, man. Well, I think, I'm not sure if this is lastly, but I think we want to talk about your book.
Sure.
That you published, what, a year ago?
Yep, November 1st.
Guns in the Hands of Artists.
Yes.
Can you tell us about it?
Sure. So Guns in the Hands of Artists is a project that originated in the mid-1990s. Artist Brian Borello and I mounted the first exhibition when my gallery was at Positive Space. And it was the real concept behind this is to take the conversation out of the highly politicized and polarized realm about this issue and bring it into the realm of art. Art is a means for dialogue. Art is the language for conversation, a different lens through which to look at this, not the screaming match of the vitriol that usually surrounds it. And so that first exhibition was 61 New Orleans artists. And basically we worked with the city to take guns off the streets in a gun buyback. Yeah. Those guns were decommissioned and then given to those artists across the community to make artwork that addresses the issue of guns and gun violence at that time in New Orleans. And so that exhibition was when my gallery was located in front of the St. Thomas Housing Project. There was AK-47 gunfire all the time. it was a very poignant place for it to emanate from, shall we say. And New Orleans always seems to be at the top of the list of homicide rates in the country, so we know from whence we speak. And in that, that exhibition kind of came and went, if you will. It was only up for a month. Thousands of people came by and saw it. New York Times did a feature article at Time Magazine. Good Morning America flew a crew down here. You know, and then the exhibition had a couple of different iterations after that. And for the next 15 years, I really thought to myself, you know, as I read about Sandy Hook and Columbine and Aurora, and you're inundated, you're bombarded with this information in America of gun violence. I mean, look at Las Vegas just a couple of weeks ago.
Almost becomes like white noise to some for some people. On the polarization front, like the folks on the other side,
we become somewhat innocuous to it. It becomes
too normal.
We accept it as normal, that in of itself is a problem in this country. And I think that we can't seem to understand that. So, you know, I thought to myself, you know, well, what can I do? So in 2012, we started working with the New Orleans Police Department, the City Council, the Mayor's Office, to obtain more guns. So we got 160 handguns, 26 long-barreled shotguns. Those guns were decommissioned by the Police Department in the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. I then proceeded to give those to about 30-plus artists across the country, men, women, black, white, Asian, and different geographic regions, because this issue affects all of us. No one is immune. So these were museum quality artists. As my career had kind of advanced in the last 20 years, I was, you know, working at a higher level and able to approach these museum quality artists to say, would you, artists that I work with, artists that I don't work with, artists that I respected their work, artists that I wanted to work with, painters, sculptors, glass blowers, video artists, will you take these weapons, will you take these decommissioned weapons into your practice and make a work of art that addresses the issue of guns and gun violence? And it was amazing. We met 45 works of art, artists like Louise Cruz Aceseta, Mel Chin, Deborah Luster, Peter Sarkeesian, New Orleans artists like Skylar Fine, Stephen Paul Day and Sibylla Peretti. There's a number of different artists that embraced this project. And they used the thing to talk about the thing.
Right.
And so that exhibition opened in, 3 years ago, October of 2014 at my gallery for Prospect as a satellite exhibition for Prospect. And it was up for 3 months. And in that 3 month period, about 10,000 people came in the gallery to see it.
Wow.
And we did, one of the parts we did educational component. We partnered with the Youth Empowerment Project in Central City, which works with youth in the juvenile justice system between the ages of 7 and 24, to have panel discussions in the gallery. It's amazing when you stand in a room filled with artwork made from guns, you are forced to have the conversation about the issue of guns, gun violence, in this country and in this city. And I think that that's a very powerful thing that art can do, is to generate an emotional response. And through that emotional response, possibly some kind of incremental change could happen. Possibly some kind of incremental understanding or mutual understanding or common ground might be found. That's really what we're talking about.
Jeff, do you remember the exhibit that we went to in San Francisco when we were working in Outside Lands and the gallery space where we went and hung out with Katrina Call?
Was it the one that with all of the antlers and whatnot? It was antlers and guns. Yeah. I totally remember that.
It's fascinating.
Yeah.
I mean, the working with the metaphor of a gun, or the object of a gun, or the metaphor, or the visual of a gun is not new, right? But in this process, it's taking decommissioned guns off the street.
Exactly.
And allowing artists to,
so it's like social activism.
Totally. And by rolling in an educational component to it, dialogue, and then as this is traveling around the country, which I can get into a little bit, it's like partnering with community organizations that already have gun violence initiatives already. So using art as the lightning rod to generate conversation, to bring the police together, the community, different facets, but using the power of art.
And hopefully legislation changed.
Communities. That's a part of it as well. But, you know, we try to be, I don't want to say the sharp end of the spear, but we try to be the awareness generator.
Right.
And then from there, once you generate awareness and stimulate conversation, then it can dovetail into efforts to reduce gun violence, hopefully in some way. If we save one person's life, then we've done our job.
That's right.
I mean, that's what I firmly believe in. So the exhibition was here for 3 months. We did the educational components with the Youth Empowerment Project, and then through my relationship with Walter Isaacson and the Aspen Institute, they got behind it to help travel around the country. And so in the summer of 2015, we brought the exhibition to the Aspen Institute for the Aspen Ideas Festival, the Aspen Action Forum, which brings some of the most high-level people from around the world together. And then after that, the exhibition traveled to Washington University in St. Louis, where it was presented by the Sam Fox School of Art and Design, the Brown School of Social Work, which is one of the preeminent social schools in the country, and then also the Institute for Public Health, because they saw it as a public health crisis. Hmm. So it was there for a month. They did panel discussions, and they brought people through, because as we all know, St. Louis has this issue with guns, just like we do here in New Orleans, as a lot of cities do. And then from there, it went to Art Basel Miami Beach, because it is an art exhibition. About 5,000 people saw it in the course of a weekend.
Yeah.
And then from there, it went to Minneapolis, Minnesota. And in Minneapolis, which was really great, I partnered with Pillsbury United Communities. It was kind of like a United Way of that city. And we worked with them to bring the exhibition there. We kind of split it into two parts, one in the African-American community, one in the white community, so kind of a bridge between those two communities. And in addition to that, they have a lot of existing gun violence initiatives, so we kind of tailored that into that. The mayor, the police department came very supportive. And August of last year, the mayor's office, the police department, and Pillsbury United Communities raised $25,000 and took 200 guns off the streets. Those guns were then decommissioned by the police department there, and they were given, in February we had an event where they were given to artists across the community there. Yeah. And just last week I was in Minneapolis, and the exhibition opened, it's called Art Is My Weapon, the Minneapolis Installation of Guns in the Hands of Artists, opened at a gallery downtown there. So it was kind of like planting the seeds of Cycle of Change, and that really was, that community fully embraced it and took it on themselves to kind of replicate the seeds of what we had done here. And then after Minneapolis last year, it went to Washington, D.C. Senator Tim Kaine sponsored it at the Rotunda of the U.S. Senate building. Uh-huh. And it was also presented at the New America Foundation, which is a digital think tank that, like, Eric Schmidt from Google is involved with. It's a block and a half from the White House. So we took it to the power, if you will.
Yeah.
And then the next phase of this is I'm starting something called the Guns in the Hands of Artists Foundation to kind of spin off a nonprofit to be able to take it out of the object-oriented situation and into more art interventions, art actions, public art pieces across the country. And in next year, I've just started working with Mary Himes, who's the wife of Congressman Jim Himes of the 4th District of Connecticut, which is Greenwich, New Canaan area. And we're going to be doing gun buybacks, hopefully in Hartford and New Haven or Norwalk. And we were gonna, work with Connecticut artists to take guns off the streets, give them to those artists, and then the exhibition will take place at Fairfield University's Quick Center for the Arts next summer. So that's kind of the goal, is to kind of roll this across the country into different states and work with elected officials, work with police departments, work with artist communities to continue to use art as a way to stimulate dialogue. Because right now, you talking about, you know, the Mueller stuff, and in this environment that we are in, there is no conversation about this. It's just blank check for the NRA, do whatever you want. And I think that's not, you know, that doesn't help the dialogue on both sides.
Well, I said to you, Jonathan, before we started rolling tonight, that one of the most disappointing things, experiences that I had while running for city council this last 4 months, was the lack of anyone talking about gun safety legislation.
Yeah, totally.
No one would touch it.
You know, one of the things to just to be straight up and comment, that the exhibition, the project, is designed to be a forum for the exchange of ideas. It's not an anti-gun movement. It's not a gun control movement.
Sure.
But it is a common sense thing. It's these artists are, you know, as Walter Isaacson writes in the book, you know, art has always had a special place in society. It's always been a mirror for life and society, and these artists, by their artworks, are holding up a mirror to society and saying, what the fuck is going on with guns in America?
That's right.
And that's what they're doing. They're using the power. Just like the protest songs of the 1960s, Picasso's Guernica, Upton Sinclair's The Jungle. You know what I mean? Right. Think about that, right?
Exactly.
The Jungle in 1904, 1906, right, about the meatpacking industry, led to the founding of the FDA.
Right.
You know what I mean? So that's the power of art.
Totally.
And then see where it goes to from there.
I love it.
Yeah. So then the book came out. The book was published by InkShares in San Francisco. But the book is, because the exhibition can't go, it's not physically possible to bring this exhibition to every rural and urban community across the country, decided to publish a book in the project.
That's right.
So I reached out through my networks to I basically harangued these people and harassed them over the course of about 2 years. So I got contributions. Walter Isaacson wrote the introduction. Senator Tim Kaine wrote an essay. Lupe Fiasco, the rapper. Richard Ford, the Pulitzer Prize winner. Jonas Serra of the New York Times. Trymaine Lee of MSNBC. Lois Eric Eli, the former columnist for the Times-Picayune. John Barry, author of A Rising Tide. Dan Cameron, the curator. Lucy Macbeth, whose son Jordan Davis was killed in Jacksonville. Harry Shearer, voice of The Simpsons. And Mitch Landrieu, and Congressman Gabby Giffords, and her husband Mark Kelly wrote an essay. So the book is really kind of designed to foster a moderate, sensible conversation about the issue of guns and gun violence. And I will say this, 40% of the artists in the exhibition own guns, and 40% of the artists in the exhibition have been victims of gun violence. 30% of the people that have written for this book are gun owners. So
I
think we all agree we want to make America a safer place. How do we do that?
Yeah, it's not a polarized thing. Because what you're saying through this message.
And you know what's
like, don't be divisive. Let's just have a conversation.
An analogy that I use as I travel around the country speaking about this is that, you know, I always say, and if we're in New Orleans, people get it here, is that coastal erosion. Right, we're losing 68 square miles a year, some crazy number, right? It's like insane how much land we're losing.
That's right.
And it's a multi-layered problem that requires a multi-layered solution. It's climate change, it's sea level rising, it's oil companies having crisscrossed the delta there's a saltwater incursion. There's all kinds of different things. Gun violence, and it's the same thing. Education, poverty, lack of opportunity, access to weapons.
Systemic.
Safety. Yeah, it's systemic, but it requires a multi-layered solution. It's not, there is no, no pun intended, there is no magic bullet.
Exactly. And it's funny that you make that analogy, because my next question was going to be like, when are you going to do the same project about climate change?
So, you know, it's interesting. People come and ask me, like, what are you doing the next thing? And it's like, you know, one of my friends said you should call it Drowned.
Right.
And it's like, you know, that's... Yeah. You know, it's something that I firmly believe in, is using art as a catalyst for social change. I truly believe that that's what I think makes me different, maybe as an art dealer or whatever you want to call it, is that I'm a commercial gallery owner, but I like to ply the middle. It's called social entrepreneur. It's like doing good and doing business.
Because
you know what? These artists that are in this exhibition, the way that I got these high-level museum-quality artists to agree was saying, I'm going to try and sell your work.
That's right.
So I'm going to sell your work and make a point at the same time, because if I ask them to give it to me, they'd be like, I don't have time for that.
Exactly.
Yeah. If you know, this is the real world.
This is the real world.
Thank you.
Enlightened self-interest.
Yeah. Yes. But you know what? And it makes for the best product out there. It makes the best point, because if you know, what do we say? If you want something for free, you get what you pay for.
Yeah.
You know, and
for sure.
The quality of work in this, every piece, there was 33 artists, 45 pieces, not one piece of artwork in the exhibition addressed the same issue. 40 from kids with guns to cultural guns to music. I mean, it's amazing, yeah. You know?
So where do people find the book?
You can find it on Amazon.com or Inkshares.com.
Yep.
You can also check out my gallery, which is JonathanFerraraGallery.com. I can spell it for you, JonathanFerraraGallery. gallery.com.
Nice.
So there's more information. Also, to find out more about the foundation is gunsinthehandsofartists.org.
Gotcha. Cool, man. Well, Jonathan, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank
my
you.
Pleasure.
Appreciate it, man.
Yeah, totally.
It's really a pleasure to have you. I feel more enlightened about you.
This is just the tip of the iceberg, man.
Right.
Talk about this, and there's that's, you know, I've in traveling around the country, this is something that every community is passionate about, is upset about, is confused about. And if I could tell you how many people I've met who have lost people, I'll leave you with one thought that I think is important. You know, we live in America, right? We're a market-driven economy.
That's right.
Right? Yeah. It's all about dollars and cents in this country.
Of course.
Conservative estimates that researchers say that gun violence costs us $229 billion a year.
Wow.
That's $1 billion a day.
Right.
And if we're a market-driven economy, how can we afford that drag on our economy? Let alone the 33,000 people that we lose every year. 10,000 to homicides, 23,000 to suicides.
Joel and I had an interesting proposition that we put out there, kind of semi-jokingly, but I actually think that there's some teeth to it. Which is that we were like, okay, we will give you 2 free guns if you have a conversation about gun safety, or
support gun safety legislation,
or I will give
reasonable
you
reasonable gun control.
You are not required to have any gun safety education whatsoever.
Yes,
harder to drive a car.
I'm like, I'll give you a gun for free in exchange for you learning how to use it safely,
totally
doing safe things with it, or having the safety technology in the gun in exchange for the one that you have now, or all of the ones that you have now.
300 million guns that are out there.
So I'll give you a free gun that can only go off if you put your hand on it. Right? How about that?
Right. There's just crazy, so that we can crazy statistics.
But it's like it has to start somewhere. Like I'm like, so You aren't robbed from any of the reasons or the rationales that you give as like a super gun enthusiast for having a gun, right? So what are those reasons? I need it for self-defense. If the government decides to take over, I'll be able to defend myself, whatever. I mean, they run the gamut from ridiculous. But here it is. Have a free gun that doesn't take away any of those things. But can we talk about it being safer?
I mean,
because like you can't get anybody to talk about it at all.
There's
a side of the issue that's completely intransigent.
You dovetail into this, the power of art, right? So I'm going to pick a piece out of this exhibition here, and it's done by an artist named Marcus Kenny, and it's called "Girl with a Gun," and this piece is to describe it to your listeners out there. It's a young girl in a white dress who's looking up, and she's dancing in the yard with a gun in her hand. It's a decommissioned gun. So it's a beautiful photograph. It's like 43 inches by 56 inches high. And I sent the decommissioned gun to Marcus Kenny, who's a photographer in Savannah, Georgia, went to SCAD. And he is known for taking photographs that are not staged, kind of in situ, and just random spontaneous photographs that are beautiful. So he has the decommissioned gun on his bedside table. He comes home from the decommissioned gun on his bedside table. He comes home from the studio. And his daughter is in the yard dancing, and he goes, oh my God, that's a beautiful picture. He snaps the picture, and then he's like, wait a second. That could have been a loaded gun.
That's right.
That's right.
And then so,
and then
in his bio statement, in his artist statement, that really says so. Then in the research in 2002, because you can't get any more research because it's been defunded.
That's right.
In this 1.7 million, the number of kids under age 18 who lived in homes with a loaded and unlocked firearm in 2002. Center for Disease Control is the source. One. The number of states with a law requiring gun owners to lock up their firearms, that state is Massachusetts. Subsequently, New York is now on that list as well.
Right.
It's like...
It's unbelievable.
Right?
It's just crazy. We can't have a conversation about locking up your firearm.
Exactly.
Like, that's
Because they made the argument... They make the slippery slope argument.
Don't we all agree that we want to protect our children?
Yes.
That's what I say.
Yeah, here's a slippery slope. It slides right into the hand of your kid.
And they die.
And then your kid's dead.
How many times do we read about this in the paper? You know, this is...
Oh, I know.
This is
this
issue just kind of can get... You know, there's... You talk about mass shootings. Do you know what a mass shooting is? It's four people or more that have been killed.
Sure.
Not like 60. It's
four. Yeah.
Right. And in the 275 days this year, 273 mass shootings. And
that doesn't talk about
the daily violence that happens on the streets of America.
No, I mean,
it's a multi-complicated issue. But you know, if we don't continue to talk about it, we're never going to be able to change any of this. And 90% of the population, statistics say, 90% of the populations believe in some responsible form of gun legislation.
Right. Yeah, I know.
So where is that 90%? That's 270 million people believe in that.
I would say that a good place to start a conversation is with Victoria Coy, who we had on on the show, and who was talking about how the mechanisms behind the scenes in legislatures and how it is that the NRA works and how much money and power they have and the destructive capacity, the way in which they work is really crazy. It's like she described the woman who is the NRA representative in the state of Florida as a person who envisions herself in the same way that Kevin Spacey's character envisions himself on House of Cards and behaves that way in terms of other people. In other words, if you don't vote a certain way, and when I mean vote a certain way, I mean if you have even a wisp of dissent on any level, the billboards that declare you as anti-gun, as an actual anti-gun liberal, even if you're the most staunch conservative, are going up in your hometown.
Right.
And she's going to pay for that, and she's going to pay for the opponent, and the opponent's going to beat you in the next election.
That's right. That's the reality of the situation, and that's, you know, the process has been hijacked by that, and I don't think, I mean, where is the voice of that 90%? You know, think about this, whatever the numbers might be as far as dollars and cents go, but if 90, on the one side you have the NRA, on the other side you have Everytown USA, Gabby Giffords, Americans for Responsible Solutions, the Brady Campaign, Moms Against Gun Violence, Lock Up Your, there's a splintered, if they all came together and coalesced into one organization,
sure,
that voice could be very powerful. But it's not a one-issue one-issue situation. That's what comes up in elections. And, you know, that's also states have the craziest laws
when it comes to
things as well. I mean, it's like every state's different. I mean, as I've traveled around, I've learned some crazy things about the different laws in Colorado and Missouri. And it's like...
Oh, my God, the laws in Nevada.
Yeah, I mean, it's just...
It's basically there are no regulations.
I think that at some point... You know, one of the people that writes in the book is Maria Cuomo Cole, who's Mario Cuomo's daughter, Andrew Cuomo's sister and husband, wife of Kenneth Cole, writes in the book, you know, if a situation like Sandy Hook, where children were murdered, does not spur us to action, what will? I mean, look at Las Vegas. What's happened since Las Vegas? There's all this noise, there's all this bluster, and then...
What happened is there was a run on guns. People's, like, gun sales went up.
That happens every time.
That happens every time, exactly. You know, the liberal agenda is the greatest gift to the NRA and gun sales that, you know, Sturm Ruger has ever heard of. The other thing that happens is this, is that the people who are the victims then suddenly get transformed into Bleeding Heart Liberals by this hardcore right-wing segment, and they get attacked themselves. So these people are being attacked relentlessly right now online, and I'm telling you this, that there's a social media component to the NRA that's fueling that. That's encouraging people to do that.
One of the things that needs to be focused, if we do not engage the other side in this conversation and find some common ground, then we can't just vilify the NRA specifically for that, because we have to engage people in this conversation and find some kind of moderate, sensible common ground, if that's even possible. I don't know if that's possible. But what this project is designed to do is to use the power of art to stimulate that conversation. When I was in Aspen, we did a panel discussion at the Aspen Institute. And at the end of this panel discussion, a man stood up and he said, you know, I'm an NRA member. I'm a proud gun owner, but I think that things have gone too far. This exhibition, nice, and I would say this book, provides a safe space for me, for us to have that conversation.
Mm. Yep.
That's what this is all about, because if you don't have the conversation, you're never going to change anything. You're not going to bring people together to have a conversation about this, because it just becomes a screaming match for or against gun control. Let's try and find even an inkling of common ground. Let's find something. Sure. And move forward from there, because this polarization is killing us. It's killing people, and we need to figure out how we do that.
Polarization is toxic.
And every other country in the world is looking at us. And I mean, when I travel, people are like, "What the fuck is with American guns?"
That's right.
I was in Switzerland. People are like, "What is your?" Like, it always comes back. Like, the thing is, "What's up with guns in America?"
That's right.
And I don't know if I have an answer.
That's right.
You know, we have a Second Amendment. We have to respect the Second Amendment. Sure, I understand that. But what does that mean? And how is that interpreted?
Maybe it's time to rewrite the Constitution.
An amendment.
Let's update the amendment.
It's based on the
interpretation of the amendment and the current structure. But that, it's about the power. I'm going to read something else to you, because I just can't help myself with this book. Sometimes it's like it's actually... You know, having published this book, and there are words in here that speak volumes, because this is not the first time these conversations have been had, and it really won't be the last time. And so Michael Waldman, who was a former speechwriter for President Clinton, is the president of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU Law School of Law. He writes in here, excuse me. There are over 300 million civilian firearms in the United States. For millions of law-abiding citizens, firearms are a part of a cherished culture. It is possible to have a meaningful individual right together with a strong sense of safety. That is a fight that will have to be waged first in the public mind. Abraham Lincoln said it best at an earlier time of constitutional turmoil. Speaking of slavery, he declared, "Public sentiment is everything. With public sentiment, nothing can fail. Without it, nothing can succeed. Consequently, he who molds public sentiment goes deeper than he who enacts statutes or pronounces decisions. He makes statutes and decisions possible or impossible to be executed." The NRA understood that. Now those who want a different vision of the Second Amendment need to absorb that insight and put it to work.
Boom. Well said. That might be a good time to drop the mic on this episode.
Yeah, there you go.
Folks, it's Guns in the Hands of Artists. It's Jonathan Ferrara. CAC on Thursday panel discussion. You got...
Sin Titulo, Contemporary Mexican Art.
Contemporary Mexican Art, and you're going to be at the Mexican Consulate, and the other gallery is yours.
Yes.
Yes. and that's the Jonathan Ferrara Gallery. So you can check out his website. Dude, great work by you.
Thank you.
Kudos, man.
Thank you.
Kudos. And see him out at Jazz Fest.
The guy in the white dress.
That's right. It's always a good time. And the last thing I'll say as a plug is that I just got a text from Cousin Andy that he's coming in town for the Fats Domino Second Line.
Oh, wow. So Cousin Andy's going to be on the show for sure.
That's right.
That's great. And then Egg Yolk Jubilee is starting our month-long residency at DBA on Monday nights starting in November. So we'll be there, folks. Come on out.
Word.
All right, folks. See you next time. It's a goodlifebabe.com. Jeff and Joel's Tales from
New Orleans. You ride.
No, we